To receive weekly mailings of Rabbi Mansour's tapes or to sponsor a tape, call 718-375-1023. To hear Rabbi Mansour's daily halakha or to search the Rabbi's database of halachot, visit www.dailyhalacha.com. That's DAILYHALACHA.com. And now, Rav Mansour.
We're studying Parashat Ki Tissa. Just say some ideas on this parasha. In the beginning of the parasha, it talks about the law of Mahasita Shekel. If you're familiar, there was a law that demanded all the men from 20 years old and up to give a half a coin called the Mahasita Shekel, and this was used for different purposes. One purpose was it was a census. That's the way they used to count the people. Everybody would get half a coin, and they would count the coins, and that's how they would know how many people are in Bnei Yisrael. From here we learned that you're not supposed to count Jews by head. You're never supposed to count Jews 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You never do that. That's, God forbid, it can bring bad things, the Gemara says. That's why we always, we like to count, you count the fingers, they put out their fingers, or you count the coins, like in this case over here. When we're counting in a minyan, we don't count heads either. We have a pasuk that has 10 words in it. So we just say the pasuk, and each word goes on a guy, and if we finish the pasuk, we know we have 10 men in the room. If we don't finish, we know we're short. Some people say, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech ha'olam, ha'motzi le'am min ha'aretz. There's ten words in ha'motzi le'am min ha'aretz, and therefore they do it that way. In any event, it was also used as a charity. I mean, they used to use this money to fund the korbanot for the Mishkan. Mishkan is a very expensive proposition. They're bringing sacrifices every day. So who pays for this? Well, the Jews every year would kick in half a coin. It's a minimal amount. But with that money, they would use to pay for the korbanot. One word on the half a shekel. The Torah uses the word venatenu. Venatenu means, and you should give. Now, venatenu is a palindrome. What is a palindrome? That's a word that it's read both the same way when you read it forwards and when you read it backwards. Venatenu forwards, venatenu, and you shall give. Read venatenu backwards, it's also venatenu. What's the significance in this forward-backwards thought? So the Baal HaTorim teaches us a lesson from over here about giving charity. Charity is a two-way street, he says. When you give this way, God gives the other way. Which means when you give, you get. A person shouldn't think when he's giving charity, so he's losing. So now he's out the $100 that he gave to Tzedakah. Hence the pasuk says, Venatenu, give this direction. But know that Venatenu is read backwards also to say that when you give, God gives, and therefore there is no loss. It's interesting, the Gemara has a word on charity. The Gemara says the following, Melach Mamon Haser. What do these three words mean? Melach is salt. Mamon is money. Gemara says, if you want to salt your money, Haser, give it out. What does that mean? Salt your money, give it out? What do these three words mean? So the rabbis explain like this. A lady salting a piece of meat. What happens when a person salts a piece of meat? Some of the juices, besides the blood, but some of the juices of the meat also, they go away. So there's a person that's a miser. He says, you know what? In the olden days, they used to salt meat also to preserve the meat. Salt is a preservative. They didn't have frigidaires and freezers in those days, so they would put a mound of salt on the piece of meat and it would protect it from getting spoiled. So there's one miser guy comes along and says, I'm not going to salt the meat, because if I salt it, I'm going to lose the juice. So he doesn't salt the meat. What ends up happening? He loses the whole piece. The whole piece goes spoiled. So sometimes to preserve a piece of meat, you have to salt it and be willing to give up some of the juice in order to save the actual meat itself. They say the same thing with money. Person has money, if he doesn't give any to charity, and he's not willing to part with some of it, so then the money spoils. Then God forbid the money is limited. The money, God forbid, it goes. God takes it. Melach mamon. So if you want to salt your money, how do you salt money? Chaser, give it out. Be willing to give the 10% in order to keep the 90. But if you try to hold on to the 100, then already it's like trying to hold on to the whole piece of meat, and then you lose everything. Following that, the Torah tells us the story of the Mishkan, the tabernacle that was built and constructed by a man called Bezalel, Ben Uri Ben Hur. Torah goes out of its way to tell us who his grandfather was. Bezalel was the grandson of a man called Hur. Hur, incidentally, was the son of Miriam. So this man over here is a great, great grandson of Miriam. Name is Bezalel. Rabbis tell us that Hur also had a very important role in this week's Perasha. The Jewish people worshipped the Egel, the golden calf, in this week's Perasha. And as a result of the Jewish people worshipping the Egel, before they did it, they came to the rabbi at the time who was leading the people. His name was Hur. You see, Moshe was in heaven getting the Torah 40 days and 40 nights. So Moshe, before he left, he put Aharon, his brother, and Hur in charge. And he told the people, any questions you have, you go to these two men. So they went to Hur. And they told Hur, listen, we're interested in building an Egel. What do you think? He heard Egel, golden calf, says Shema Yisrael. He says, you can't do it. Haram, Abisir, Asur. He went crazy. You can't do it. But we want to do it. We have good intent. There's no such thing as good intent. Pass. I'm not going to let you do it. Unfortunately, the people didn't like that answer. And the rabbis tell us in Gemara that the Jewish people killed Hur. Yeah, they killed him. This is an extreme reaction to disagreeing with your rabbi. You know, it's one thing to fire the committee firing a rabbi because they don't agree with him. But to kill him, that's a little that's still too much. It's a little too violent for me. In any event, they killed him. The greatness of Hur was that he didn't make any calculations or compromises when it came to doing something wrong. Which means Hur could have rationalized and said, you know, listen, they're going to kill me, so let them do it. I'll monitor it. I'll make sure that it doesn't get out of hand. You could rationalize. When your life is on the line, so then already you can always look at it in a different light. Hur's greatness was, it's haram. It's asur. I'm not making any calculations. Finished. I'm not going to start saying, well, maybe and if and do. You want to kill me? Kill me. You can't do it. Finished. He was strong. He was straight. He was committed to his principles. A man that made no calculations when it came to right and wrong. How does God pay back Hur? Hur has a grandson called Bezalel. In this week's Perasha, it tells us something about Bezalel. God says, I filled them with wisdom to do what? Lashov machashavot, to make calculations. In building the Mishkan, you needed to be an architect. How much gold? How much silver? How do you make it? How do you design it? You have to be a master in mathematician. You have to be a master in design. Somebody that's good in construction has to be able to make proper calculations. Has to make the proper assessments. So God is telling Hur, as a result of you not making any calculations for the sake of God. You did what is right. I'm going to reward you with a grandson that is going to make the ultimate calculations also for God in building the Mishkan. So there's a payback between Hur and his grandson, Bezalel. Hur makes no calculations for God. He does what's right. Bezalel makes only calculations for God to build the Mishkan. Now, there's a famous story they always tell over in this week's Parasha. I'm not going to deprive you from it, even though some of you might have heard it. The Torah tells us, in making these calculations, it says, Lachshov machashavot, La'asot bazahav bakesef ubanehoshet. He was able to make calculations with the gold and with the silver and the copper. So there's this famous story told in the Volozhin Yeshiva. Volozhin Yeshiva was headed by Rav Chaim Volozhin. And of course, every yeshiva has a budget, and the budget rests on the Rosh Yeshiva to go out and collect. In that yeshiva, he happened to have an administrator. And his job was to go out and collect money. Rav Chaim Volozhin gave the administrator a list. And he told me, here's all the pledges that we get from all the people. And there was one man that had committed every year to give 50% of the budget. So this was a major player over here. So he tells the administrator, make sure when you go to this guy, he's the key guy. He gives us half the budget. It's fine. The administrator tells the Rosh Yeshiva, listen, you know, when you go collect money, Rabbi, they're giving because you're a man of stature, Rosh Yeshiva. They can't tell you, no, I'm a simple guy. They're going to see me wearing this, suit that's all ripped and torn. They're not going to respect it. I need to dress like a Hashuv person. Chaim Volozhin says, fine, go buy yourself a suit. He buys himself a suit. He tells him, listen, what's a good suit worth if I don't have a nice pair of shoes with it? I mean, the shoes make the whole suit over there. The first thing the businessman looks at is the shoes. If the shoes don't look polished, he's going to say, this guy's a schlub. We're not going to give any money to this yeshiva. Chaim said, the truth is you have a point. You need a good pair of shoes. Take a pair of shoes. Go buy a pair of shoes. Then he tells him, listen, Hacham, it's not for me, but, you know, I'm going with papers, I'm checks, money. Where am I putting all this stuff here? I'm going to put it in my pocket. I'm going to look sloppy. I need maybe an attaché case, leather case, something just for the people. Rabbi says, go buy yourself a case. Then he tells him, one more thing, Hakam, I'm going from house to house, from city to city. How am I getting to these places? You know, if I'm going to walk from place to place, so all my suit that I just bought is going to get dirty, and I'm going to be sweaty and all that. I need a driver. In those days, they didn't have drivers, of course, but that horse and carriage. Rav Chaim said, okay, we'll hire a horse, we'll hire a buggy, sit on the thing, he'll take you from place to place. Oh, he went from house to house, he's collecting money for the yeshiva. He gets to the wealthy man. The wealthy man looks out the window, he sees a horse and carriage, a guy comes out, dapper, dressed. He says, I'm representing the Volozhin Yeshiva, I came, from the rabbi, 50%, you're down. He says, no, I can't give anything, I had a rough year, I'll see you later, but leave me alone. The guy was shocked. Give him anything from 50% of the budget to nothing. He goes back to Rav Chaim. He shows him the list. He says, what? The guy didn't give you anything? Can't be. The guy's a millionaire. He didn't give me anything. Rav Chaim says, I have to go myself. Rav Chaim goes to visit the rich man. The rich man sees Rav Chaim coming. He comes out of his door. Hakam, I don't believe it. You came to my house. Please, I'll be sure he brings him in. Sit. So Rav Chaim says, please, you have to tell me. Be honest with me. You give us 50% of the budget. You gave our guy nothing. Well, how do you explain this? He said, Hakam, I can be honest with you. In my mind, when I was giving money to support Volozhin Yeshiva, I always thought that my money's going to pay for the guys to learn Torah, maybe to pay for the books, maybe to pay for the food in order to feed the yeshiva men so they can study Torah. It was always my mind. I understood where my money was going. But now I see a guy come in with a suit and a horse and buggy and all this thing. I said, Naki, like, I'm giving my money now to pay for straw to feed the horses. I'm paying now to pay for transportation for this guy. I'm not interested. Rav Chaim said, you have a good point. Let me answer your question. And if my answer is adequate, you can make your decision. He said, what does the Torah mean when it says that Bezalel knew how to make calculations with the gold and the silver and the copper. Isn't that obvious? Doesn't every architect have to know basic mathematics? Well, the Torah goes out of its way to say, Lachshov Mahashavot. He knew how to make calculations. So Rav Chaim said like this. In the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, gold was needed. Now, gold was used in three different places. In the Holy of Holies, in the Holy, and in the courtyard. Now, of course, if I'm standing on line with a piece of gold to give it as a donation, in my mind, I want it to go into the Holy of Holies. And I want my piece of gold to go in the highest level possible. And so do every other person online. So Rav Chaim said, how did Bezalel know which gold to use for the Holy of Holies and which one to use for the Holy of Holies? How are you supposed to know this? So he says, Bezalel had an uncanny ability to read the person's mind when he was online giving the money. And based on his intent, if a person was giving idealistically for l'shem shamayim because he wants to, you know, build a sanctuary for God, oh, that's nice, that's pure. You go in the Holy of Holies. You have another guy's giving, and he's giving also for prestige, so he can brag to his friends, oh, you know, I gave 2,000, I gave it, he took it, it's nice, but that's not Holy of Holies. That would put you in the Holy. Another guy's purely motivated only for what people are going to say. He just wants to show off. He doesn't really care. He's just giving for the fanfare. We'll take that guy's money also, but we put it in the the outer part. Now, of course, none of these people were verbally expressing these thoughts. They were in their minds. But the Torah says, Lachshov Mahashavot. Lachshov Mahashavot can be understood. Bezalel knew the thoughts of the donators. Lachshov, he knew the thoughts that were running through their minds. Hence, Bazahav, Bekesef, Banechoshet. He knew how to appropriate the funds and put them in their proper spots. So Rav Chaim told the benefactor, he said, listen, God knows your intent. When you gave the money to the yeshiva, you gave it idealistically. You gave it the Shem Shamayim. I have no doubt that the money you give is paying for the books, is paying for the lighting, is paying for the food. Another guy that gives, less idealistically, his money will go pay for the, for the bathroom supplies, for the cleaning supplies. Yeshiva needs that also. But it all depends on the intent of the giver. And the guy that's giving only for kavod and honor, trust me, he's paying for the horses and the stable and the barn. Again, the yeshiva needs that also. It's an expense. But rest assured, God will make sure that the money you give, the Shem Shamayim, will be rooted to the highest level. It's a lesson for us when we give charity. You give charity, it's not enough to give, but if you want your money to serve you in the best way possible, so then the intent of the giver should be solely for the sake of Hashem, without getting anything back for it, without any honor and fanfare and so on. There's a big debate amongst the rabbis. Is it proper to announce pledges from the pulpit, or is it better not to? Some rabbis say, yeah, it's better to go anonymous. You know, let them get up and say, anonymous $5,000. Of course, then you're not getting any honor. You're giving it totally for the mitzvah. You're not benefiting any perks from your charity. Other rabbis have a different approach, and this is what we follow, that it's more proper to announce the names from the pulpit. Not to give the man kavod, but in order to inspire others to give. You see, if people are seeing it, they're going to say, oh, Mr. So-and-so, he gave $5,000. This man, he's an important man. He's a very smart man. If he gives us, puts his money to this cause, so therefore I'm going to join him also. So as a motivating factor, it's okay to have your name announced, even to put a plaque up, or have your name printed. But if that's what you want, only to be printed so you can have your name in lights, your charity is a mitzvah. I don't say no. And your charity will serve you, but it might not be appropriated for the highest level. Hence, Bezalel was a genius of geniuses. He had an ultrasound in his eyes. He was able to read right through a person's inner thoughts. Lachshov Mahashavot. Hence, to place the money where it was supposed to be. The Torah then tells us in Perasha about the laws of Shabbat. I heard a nice story. We're talking about the Shabbat. There's a custom amongst the Hasidim that on Shabbat morning, when they make Kiddush, right after they make Kiddush, they always have mizonot first, cake and cookies and things like that. And after they have that, then they go wash hamotzi. A little like what we do with the mazah, but they have, that's a standard thing. They always have cookies and cake first, after they make kiddush in the day. Other communities have a custom, no, they make kiddush, right away they wash, they have bread and finish. As a matter of fact, if you go into the stores by the Hasidim, they have, the chali boards. Our chali boards say on it, Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, some of them. They have chali boards that say on it, Borei Minim Mizonot. They use it Saturday morning. They put their cookies on it, they make kiddush, and have cookies after. It's a custom. Now, the story is told, I found it a great story, about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. One of his students noticed that it was Shabbat afternoon, Shabbat morning, Rabbi made Kiddush, and then they sat down and had cookies and cake and mizonot. So the student asked the Rabbi, "Rabbi, you're not a Hasid. You're not part of that community that does such a custom. From where did you get this from? Where did you pick this up from?" So Rav Yaakov answered like this. He says, "My second wife that I'm married to now, she comes from a family of Hasidim that have this custom. And her first husband was also a Hasid. My wife is used to making Kiddush like this. And therefore, in order to make her comfortable, in order to make her feel normal, that she's doing what she's normally accustomed to do, not to make her feel uncomfortable, that the Shabbat for her should feel like she always had Shabbat. Kiddush means you have Kiddush and you have some Mezonot. So I broke with my custom in order to make my wife feel more comfortable." Now that's an amazing concept, because Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky married his second wife at the age of 70. Now that means probably for 50 years he was making Kiddush and then Hamotzi. You know how difficult it is that once people have their system, this is the way we're doing it for 50 years, making Kiddush every Shabbat. Now to change from you and break from your custom in order to make a second wife feel hashuv, in order to feel important, in order that he has an extra added amount of sensitivity, this is already a greatness of the Hakam. The Hakam is trying to teach you, you might argue, breaking with custom, better to break with custom in order to keep shalom bayit, in order to keep the tranquility, in order to make somebody else feel good. Change from a practice that you got used to doing for 50 years. It's worth it in order to make another Jew feel happy. Now we go to the to the hardest part of the perasha. Right, it's hard for us to keep away from the story of the story of the egel itself, story of the golden calf. Not an easy subject at all. Last night, and God willing, on Shabbat, we'll try to explain it in depth, exactly how the Jewish people came to worship a golden calf. As we explained, it's definitely the most misunderstood episode in the entire Tanakh, without a doubt. Our points today that we want to make is, the Torah writes that the Jews worshipped the Egel very, very quickly. The Torah uses a language, Saru Maher. They turned from God very fast. You know, the day before, they're worshipping Hashem. The next morning, boom, they're bringing sacrifices to a golden calf. That poses a great problem. How is it possible overnight to come worship idolatry? While the Gemara tells us that the Yetzer Hara, whose mission is to get us to make sin, works at a very slow pace. He knows if you're going to wake up tomorrow morning, he's going to tell you, go to church. You tell him, jump in the lake. I'm not going to church. So it's a slow process. He works on a person for years and years and years till he finally breaks him down. Then he can tell him, go worship Avodah Zarah. But that cannot happen overnight. So all the rabbis ask, how then in this case did it happen overnight? One night they went to sleep, religious Jews. The next morning they wake up, Egel, Avodah Zarah. How do we explain the speed that the Jewish people fell? Rav Chaim Shmulevitz answers, one word answer, depression. And he reminds us of what the rabbis tell us, what precipitated the Egel. The Satan was up to one of his most devious schemes ever. On that morning of the Egel, Satan made the world dark. It was like an eclipse. People woke up, what's going on in the world over here? And then all of a sudden, Satan comes to the Jewish people and says, by the way, your leader Moshe, he's not coming back. He's not coming back. He told us 40 days, he's coming back. Satan then went and made an image of Moshe in a coffin and showed it to the Jewish people floating over the mountain. So the Jewish people come out, they see the world dark, they see Moshe Rabbeinu dead. So they became so disoriented. They became so confused and became so desperate. In that desperation, they went and they fell from their level so fast that what would normally take 60 years of the Yetzer Hara to accomplish, in this case, he was able to accomplish it overnight. Because when people become depressed, when they become alarmed or startled, so now their spiritual resistance becomes very low. A person's in a bad mood. Person's upset. He'll do anything. What do you mean? That's it. He's fed up with life already. Now, what normally he'd never imagined to do, but when a person is in a depression or he has the blues, so now already he gives up. You know, life means doesn't mean anything. And therefore we can come to make the worst and the greatest avonot with great speed. I always tell over to the boys how when we were in school, we had great rabbis that used to monitor not only our intelligence in learning, but more importantly, they would monitor our emotional stability. Many times when we'd come into school, the rabbi would see sometimes we're a little down. For whatever reason, it could be a frivolity reason or it could be an important thing. But right away he'd come to us, the rabbi, and tell us, you know, you look a little depressed. He says, you can't remain like this, you know. You have to go to all extremes to get yourself out of this. Because the Yetzer Hara wishes you to be in that stage. Because he can accomplish tremendous success with depressed people. So he used to always tell us, go to the ice cream store and buy an ice cream. You know, to our rabbi, this was like a great indulgence. Like, you know, do we have a tent to go get an ice cream? So I'll never forget, one day I took the rabbi's advice, and I'm going to go to the ice cream store, and I bought for myself ice cream with, cappuccino, with sprinkles and all sorts of accessories on top of it, and all that other stuff. So when I came back, the rabbi saw it. He says, hey, relax. I meant the vanilla cone with a little... you're not manic depressed, are you? I mean, what is this over here? This is outrageous. But you see over here, I learned the lesson. You must get yourself out of these ruts that they call them. Do whatever it is, to take a walk, to go, to listen to music. Do things, of course, that are permissible, but just to break the... Break that monotony of the depression in order to get out of it. And if you see somebody in it, it's an obligation. It's a walking time bomb. It's an obligation to do anything you can to get them out. I'll tell you a story that Gemara says. Gemara says I read these Gemariot and I'm marveled by the priorities of the Torah. Eliyahu Navi was once walking in the marketplace and he met a rabbi. So the rabbi saw Eliyahu Navi, so I want to ask you a question. Which question do you think he asked Eliyahu Navi? He tells him, could you tell me in this marketplace, who's going to Olam Abba? So Eliyahu Navi looks long and hard, and he looks, and he says, those two guys over there. Shocked, okay. They didn't look like the biggest tzaddikim. They weren't even dressed with Jewish garb. So the rabbi goes to these two guys and says, could you tell me what's your profession? What do you do for a living? So they say, Baduhe Anan. We're comedians. We're jokes. We make jokes. You make jokes? What do you mean you make jokes? What do you do? He says, we walk up and down the marketplace. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes business is slow. And you have the merchants, they're sitting in front of their store. And they're despondent. You know, they're upset. There's no customers. They have to pay bills. They have pressures. They have anxiety. So we just roam the marketplace up and down. And whenever we see a despondent merchant, we sit down with him, we make jokes, we make light of things, we cheer up his spirits. Once we get him to crack a smile, we move on to the next guy. Look at that. Out of all the Jews walking in the marketplace, Eliyahu Navi says, these two men over here, they gain Olam Abba. So I once heard a nice explanation. Based on what we're saying today, we understand why having such a nature of not a comedian making dirty jokes, God forbid, we're talking. We're not talking about a comedian over there that has a perverted sense of humor. We're talking about comedians over there that are using their sharp wit and using their nice humor in order to make people happy. That's what we're talking about over here. So it's not about stand-up comedians over here. Obviously, the Torah is not letzanut over here. We're not talking about clowns. We're talking about people that are mature individuals that use their talent in order to make people happy. I saw an explanation that says like this. For that you get Olam Abba. It's nice. It's a good thing. It's noble. So they said like this. Because when Jews are depressed, God is depressed. You see, our God shares in the pain of his people. When Jews are suffering, God himself suffers. I'll give you an example. You remember when God came to Moshe Rabbeinu to tell him to take the Jews out of Egypt? He came in the form of a burning bush. That was a thorn bush. Why would God appear in a thorn bush? Why doesn't he come in on an orange tree, in an orange grove? Why doesn't he come in a vineyard? A thorn bush is it's an uncomfortable place to be. God is saying, so long as my Jews are in Egypt suffering, if I'm going to reveal myself, I have to reveal myself in a place to show that I'm commiserating with my people. I'm in a thorn bush. I'm uncomfortable also, so to speak, with my people. God commiserates with the pain of his children. So when these comedians were going in the marketplace cheering up merchants, who were they actually alleviating? They were alleviating the pain of God. Because by making the children of God happy, God says, oh, now my people are happy, now I can be happy. It's like a parent. When a parent sees his children upset, the parent is upset. Even though the parent has everything and the parent doesn't have the problem that the child has, but when a parent sees the kid upset, the parent can't sleep at night. So when you go and make the child happy, you're really making the parent happy also. That's exactly what God does. When God's children become happy, God becomes happy. Is there any greater thing in the world to give God pleasure? And therefore, ladies, it's a great mission in life when you see people that are down. You see the dangers what can happen when people are depressed. They can commit an egg or a golden calf 0 to 60 in 3 seconds and in record time. And therefore, we must do anything. If it means to eat ice cream, like I said, or take a walk, or listen to music, other things like that. Anything but to be out of a depression. You remember, it's not so common today, but in the olden days, they used to have these missionaries that used to hang out in the airports. You know, giving out all sorts of paraphernalia and all that type of stuff. And you ever think why they hang out in the airports? We say simple because people, a lot of people. No, that's not the explanation. Because in people that are traveling in airports are people that are not, a lot of times, unstable. They're not, some people are running away from marriages, some people are running away because of business problems, some people are traveling because God's with somebody's sick. So you're catching a person when he's, you know, not everybody's going to Disney World in the airport. So you're catching a person sometimes when he's down and he's vulnerable. Now that he's down, you can sell him anything. You could give him Avodah Zarah and he'll buy it. So therefore the airport is a perfect place for these missionaries to prey on desperate people that are looking for something. Or they're more open to hear today than they would be during another time. Let me talk about Moshe Rabbeinu for a second, how he prayed for the Jewish people, because God committed himself to destroy the Jewish nation after the Egel. He said, finish, it's over. Destroy everybody, and I'll start from scratch. New nation, and Moshe, don't worry, your career is intact. You'll be the leader of the new nation. And Moshe Rabbeinu, in an act of leadership and responsibility, he tells God, if they're going down, take me down with them. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu does not abandon Bnei Yisrael and say, all right, tough luck, as long as I'm good, I'll get my pension, I'm covered, I'll have my career intact. Okay, we'll do tough luck. Moshe Rabbeinu says, impossible. If they go down, take me down with them. It's a great act of leadership only because part of the Egel ceremony, the Torah tells us, was they drank, drinking wine, and it says, Vayakumu lesachek. They were reveling. There was like dancing and music. It became like a... It got out of hand, there's no question about it. It became like a party. They got like into a frenzy, the people that worshipped the egg, and they lost themselves, and they just went, they took it to a different extreme, and it turned into a party for Avodah Zarah. Let me ask you a question. A day before, what got them into this mood to make an egel? Because they saw Moshe Rabbeinu's coffin on Har Sinai. Means they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was dead. Is that how you react the next day? You revel in a party after you think Moshe Rabbeinu, the leader, died? Now Moshe Rabbeinu can take that personally. Moshe Rabbeinu can say, look, I've got a rotten people. They thought I was dead. And the next day, what are they doing? Instead of ripping their clothes, instead of saying Kaddish, instead of crying after all I did for them, I was the guy that went to Egypt. I was the guy that had to meet with Paro. I was the guy that had to fight with all the rebels of the Jewish people. I split the sea. And now, they think that I'm dead. And how do they pay me my last respects? They celebrate the next day in front of an egel? Moshe Rabbeinu had every right to tell God, kill him. Kill him, let's start from fresh. But to show you the love that Moshe Rabbeinu had for the people and the tolerance that he had for the people. What a lesson in tolerance. Moshe Rabbeinu says the people are frail. The people made a mistake. The people, they didn't realize what they were doing. Moshe Rabbeinu did not let his ego, which he had no ego, he didn't let his ego get in the way of doing what a leader is supposed to do. He could have said, well, you know, so I'm burning. You know what? Let them die. If they can revel at my death, they don't deserve to live. Moshe Rabbeinu says, well, put your issues on this. It's not about you, Moshe. This is about the people. This is about their existence. And therefore they come first. That already is the highest level of Jewish leadership, where a person can divest himself from any personal interest and any personal ego. and just be concerned about the people themselves. Let me point out to you that Moshe's words that he uses when he tells God, if you destroy them, destroy me. He used two words. Meheni na. God, if you erase them from existence, meheni na, erase me also. Our rabbis in Zohar learn a correlation, or a distinction, I should say, between Moshe and Noah. You see, Noah was a leader of his generation, the generation of the flood. But the Zohar doesn't put Noah in the proper, in a positive light. He was a leader that saved himself and his family, but waved to the generation to their death. Noah, if he would have been like Moshe, might have pleaded with God and said, God, please, you want to destroy an entire generation? If you destroy them, take me down with them. Instead, Noah said, all right, what are you going to do? I'm good? Yeah, you're good. You're going to have a teva, you're going to have... Okay, good, I'll see you, whatever. They'll have to suffer their fate. Noah is the irresponsible leader. The leader that did not rise to the occasion in order to save the people on his shoulders. Moshe is the antithesis of Noah. Our rabbis tell us that, and I'll leave you with this, I'm not into the Kabbalah so much, and I don't understand these things so much, but Hachamim tell us that Noah, as a result of his lack of leadership, his soul was imperfect. And the soul of Noah needed to come down again in a form of reincarnation to be fixed. Where did the soul of Noah land? Rabbis tell us it landed in Moshe. And when was it fixed? When Moshe got up and said, erase me, meheni na. At that moment, Noah's lack of leadership was fixed through Moshe. But the rabbis tell us if you take the words meheni na and you boggle them, meheni na, they spell the words also minoach ani. He's saying, I'm from Noah. And because I know that I have a spark of Noah in me, I know that I must not do this only for myself, but I must also do this for Noah, who did not accomplish that in the previous generation. Hence, the words meheni na are not arbitrary words. He used those words specifically. He's alluding to the fact, me Noah ani, I'm from Noah. And therefore, this is the proper thing for myself and for my tikkun in the previous Gilgul. Baruch Adonai le'olam. Amen. Amen.